Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm Paco Romaine.
And I'm George Chen.
And this is SupDoc, a show where we talk documentaries with guests from the worlds of film, TV, comedy, and podcasts.
And we're very excited to have the director of Circus of Books on with us today, Rachel Mason. Rachel's parents, Barry and Karen, ran a gay bookstore and porn distribution company out of Los Angeles for over three decades, all while maintaining their tight-knit family.
Her film is surprising, funny, and heartfelt and is available to stream on Netflix. It also has a 98% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
And Circus of Books was just nominated for an Outstanding Nonfiction Writing Emmy.
Welcome to SupDoc, Rachel Mason.
Hi, it's so great to be here. Thanks for having me. That was a really nice intro.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was awesome. We don't really usually do live intros, but we're like, let's do something fun. Let's be surprising. So, well, thanks for being here. What an awesome documentary.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's... Wow, there's so much. There is so much going on.
There's a lot going on. Like I wrote down big themes. I'm like family, religion, civil rights, and then the sex. Death of the video store. That was also part of it.
Yep.
Just the death of retail, which is happening all around us right now. How is your family dealing with quarantine and stuff right now?
Well, you know, my parents, I mean, in a weird way in their careers, they couldn't be quarantining at a better time because they've pretty much done what they needed to do to raise their kids and be done with it. And they have enough to, you know, retire on. But they basically are workaholics no matter what. And I don't think when you're a small business owner, it ever leaves your bloodstream. So, you know, they actually own the building where Circus of Books formerly was. And it's been taken over by another really important person in the gay adult community, Shishi LaRue, who's a famous porn director. Yeah, and then Shishi LaRue has a high-end retail porn store, or sorry, more like sex products store in the Circus of Books now currently. But, of course, you know, retail is struggling, so it's a hard time for the store. But my parents are always busy with some element of the work they're doing for
Silver Lake location, do they own that building as well?
Or? Yes, they do. So that building is marijuana. So my parents have never really fully left the sex and drugs industry.
Awesome.
So moving right along.
Never rock and roll though, right?
They pretty much, you know, they like to stay on the fringe, on the edge of what's still legal. You know, they are actual major risk takers and they enjoy it. And when they go on vacation, they usually do something pretty unbelievable too. Like they'll ride their bicycles across the country or hike to the base camp of Mount Everest.
Oh, wow.
Surprising things like that they're always out. People are like, what's that old couple doing on this, you know, epic bike journey?
Whoa.
Does Barry wear his Hawaiian t-shirts when he camps, or his Hawaiian shirts?
His entire closet is one giant Hawaiian t-shirt.
Yeah,
I'm so happy by that.
Yeah, awesome. Now there's, I was reading this article that you did, you were interviewed in The Land magazine, actually. And okay. They were talking about the Circus Gallery, and that wasn't really touched on in the film at all. There was an art gallery aspect. Was that at the West Hollywood location or the Silver Lake?
Well, you know, the gallery was never really part of the store's history. It was always sort of something that I was involved in because I am an artist. And it was a kind of short-lived project in terms of the history of the store, but it was really actually very impactful in terms of the art community in LA. You know, the arts are kind of a small niche group of people, and I'm still a part of it. So my friends gave me the idea actually to do an art show in the store, and that started to pop up in, like every now and then in West Hollywood in the store. And then eventually other artists, friends said, hey, let's do something at the Silver Lake location. And then eventually, a friend of mine, John Knuth, found out about the fact that my mom had this warehouse, or my parents had this warehouse, where they stored all of their VHS and DVDs. And he walks in and is like, wow, all this stuff could go in a little tiny area in the back if your mom would be open to letting this be an art gallery. So took some convincing, and he managed amazingly to get Karen Mason to move all the products into a little what are those things called? Industrial container. And she, for a couple years, let it be an art gallery. And it actually did really well. However, the art gallery model is literally the opposite of a small Circus of Books model, where my mom would constantly come in and say, where's all the inventory? You know, why do you have four things? And why is this such an insane price? You know, why don't you get 100 things and lower the price? And John kept saying, Karen, it's a totally different business model. And I don't know how he managed to maneuver around her for the 2 years that the gallery stayed afloat. But it did well for gallery standards. But you know, not well enough for my mom to tolerate that other business. So eventually it closed.
Once a small business owner, always a small business owner.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Did your relationship with your parents change after this documentary aired?
You know, I would say the one thing that I think really did happen, well, two things. You know, it was really my mom who lived in the shadow of, you know, really a secret, a giant, huge, unwieldy, and like shameful secret for her. My dad, you know, has never ever had a problem with the business, and he's a happy-go-lucky guy, but you know, he's sort of like the, you know, the sidekick to the mafia don who, you know, runs the show. And, you know, what would always happen in the film festivals, whenever that line where my mom would say, well, if one of us was going to have to go to jail, it better be Barry. Yeah. And everybody would always laugh so hard. And I never realized that I had put in, you know, a punchline there, but I started to realize, oh my God, that's because she genuinely is the mastermind of the whole thing. And he's sort of like the hapless sidekick. And, you know, well, I guess you're going to have to go to jail then, you know, and it's this sort of funny thing. But, you know, my mom really did sort of bear the burden of the kind of like religious guilt of it all. And my dad, you know, was never religious to begin with, so he didn't care. But, you know, I think since the film has come out, well, her biggest fear was that some of her friends would see it. You know, my mom's right. Peer group are these, you know, the Jewish ladies who, you know, she's known for years, so she's never told ever, or her Catholic friend. You know, she's very, her scene is very soccer moms who are, you know, religion plays a big role in their lives. And they all watched the film and they were like, Karen, wow, we never knew. But, you know, it wasn't like God shall punish you forever.
Right.
It was just like, why didn't you tell us? You know, and I think that was her biggest revelation, was that she didn't, you know, face the kind of condemnation that she was expecting. And her fear of that condemnation, I think, was just really outweighed the actual condemnation. It's there. I've read the comments on, you know, the more public articles like LA Times, you know, quite a few, you know, Christian right people that want, you know, to see people like my parents, you know, burn in hell forever. But those are not my parents' friends, you know. And so her friend group was very much like, wow, Karen, you know, this is not a big deal. You shouldn't have been so under the cloud of suspicion. So there's that. And, you know, and I feel really happy that I was able to alleviate that, you know, pressure cooker situation, you know, for my mom, because really it kind of alleviated it. And she's been a lot more lighthearted, you know, about it all. So there's
sure.
That. Yeah.
I can't imagine holding that a 30 year or 30 plus year secret like that, especially with like around some of your best friends that you share everything with, but you're just like, and if they find out, can you imagine if you're like always facing like, if they found out kind of fear. That would be a lot.
Yeah. No, my mom really lived with this sense that everyone was going to judge her and that this was going to be, you know, the ultimate condemnation. And it just hasn't played out that way now that the film is out. And she was really scared that when the film came out, she would lose all her friends. She would tell me that, you know. She even asked one of her friends, like, are you still going to be my friend after you watch this movie?
Oh. But Barry was like, who fucking cares?
He loves it. I mean, in a funny way, I can say this. My dad, you know, gets recognized even with his mask, you know, when he walks down the street. And he just stands there. He has all these new friends. They love to talk to him. My mom, on the other hand, I think is genuinely probably the one person in L.A. that doesn't want to be famous. And so when anyone recognizes her, it's like, wow, how do they know it's me? I put the mask on. I put my hat on.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I've now seen this doc three times. I just watched it again this morning. Yeah, it was great. I mean, I saw it first on Netflix and I hadn't heard of it. And then I watched it and then people started talking about it. Well, and people talk to George and I a lot about docs anyways. They're like, have you seen this? So I saw it again and then I watched it again this morning. And I was thinking like, how many, Barry seems like the kind of guy that might have 10 to 15 nicknames. Does he have a lot of nicknames?
You know, not that I've actually ever heard, but in a funny way, I bet there's nicknames for him that the employees had or other people.
It's
that
gotta be.
Yeah, I never knew of a nickname, but I could see that now that you say it. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, the thing that I think was the best sort of comment in the film that somebody said, you know, when Karen walked into the store, you know, you buttoned up and you made sure you were, my dad walked in the store, it really was like, okay, whatever. He could care less. Yeah. I mean, he is genuinely the most chill person you'll ever meet.
Right. But, you know, still waters run deep. So like you can tell like how incredibly intelligent both your parents are. And the fact that your father invented a dialysis meter. Oh, yeah. I don't even know what it was or what it did, but
well, it's
insane.
Actually called the foam detector, and it really is an incredible thing. And in fact, one of the cool things I've had to say is that on Facebook or wherever people have written comments, every now and then someone will really write a message that is from the medical community, and they'll say, you know, I just let your dad know that his device has saved thousands of lives, and I want to let you know because I'm a phlebotomist or I'm a, you know, a nurse who works in dialysis. And I, you know, I think I never even understood how profound his device was. But funny enough, it also goes hand in hand with the times that the film centers on, like the late 70s. My dad's dad, my grandfather, was on dialysis, and it was a crisis in the dialysis machine, sort of the dialysis locations at the time. They didn't have enough staffing. So my dad would just come in there and like try to like jerry-rig things, and he would test it out on people in the, I mean, could you imagine that today? He would walk into a hospital and I mean, the thing is like duct tape and some tubes, and he has, you know, special effects training. He'd be like, well, can I try this out on the machine? And they say, okay, why not?
Yeah, and he's like, I worked with Jim Morrison, people.
Yeah, no, I mean, when I put that together, it actually gave me this whole like shocking revelation on the actual, you know, the first off, okay, there is a good reason for medical malpractice on some ways, like, okay, so that you don't have some random guy showing up and like trying out stuff on your grandfather. Yeah. But on the other hand, it also led to people like my dad truly like rigging things and figuring out stuff that the giant industries were not sort of doing in the way that was sort of easy and quicker. But my dad really never had the right business partner in that endeavor. And I mean, talk about, you know, basically David and Goliath. There was just no good way to be an outsider, show up and, you know, present a product without it getting like swallowed up immediately. So anytime he had a patent, I mean, it was sort of absurd. He would present it to some people and they would say, okay, great, we're going to steal that from you. And my dad would be like, what are you talking about? And they'd be like, well, either we're going to pay you $100 for the machine or we really will just copy it. And my dad would be like, well, how did that, you know? And I mean, that's how the industry works. It's like, there's no good way to get in it. So, you know, he was able to produce, you know, he's credited in the history books And he did actually make a chair that my parents got to be able to manufacture. So in a funny little way, when the FBI raids were happening and my parents were dealing with it, my mom thinks that part of the reason they really didn't go to jail was because when they raided the office, they weren't just dealing with people that were in porn. They were like coming up with all of these things that had to do with like medical equipment. And they were like, what are you guys actually doing here? So she's like, well, maybe it's, you know, not just, you know, porn people. You're also sort of dealing in these other products. And that was part of the defense too. The lawyer, John Weston, who actually defended the producers of Deep Throat. He's a very important First Amendment attorney. So, you know, people that watch this movie that are industry people actually also have a whole other sort of read on it because they know John Weston and John Weston knows Larry Flint. And so there's this like intertwining of these players. And John said to me, he said, you know, I didn't have a clue that your parents were going to avoid jail time. I mean, really, he said this was a dicey, dicey moment. And, you know, they would have just, you know, he had plenty of other clients who went to jail for the exact same thing. And he said, the only real thing that I was able to argue about your dad was, you know, this guy is not your typical porn guy. You know, he hasn't already done jail time. He hasn't been involved in like, you know, mafia enterprises as a lot of other people in the business were. Your dad is very wholesome. He, you know, has a college degree. He speaks in complete sentences, which John told me was actually a big important thing. Wow. My parents. Yeah. So, you know, that was sort of part of it. It was very revelatory for me because I had always heard the very vanilla version of this whole thing that my parents, you know, really made sure we never actually learn too much about they tried to keep it all a surface level understanding of what was happening.
That's pretty profound. That's insane. Especially the idea, like when it gets into the story where your dad actually goes to court because of this, because of the setup by the FBI with like an employee sent three videos to someone in
Pennsylvania,
Lebanon, Pennsylvania, or wherever it was. I mean, that should have been a clue right there. They're like, where? What? Lebanon, Pennsylvania?
I mean, the Amish country.
Yeah. Mennonites, they love their gay porn.
Yeah. Well, they might actually, but now everyone can have it.
Putting the men in Mennonites, that's one of the titles.
There you go. But your dad didn't actually serve any time, which is.
No, because, you know, it really was a confluence of events. And what my parents' lawyer, John Weston, said, you know, was that there's sort of this pre-trial thing. I mean, I should have probably prepared myself to get into the legal dialogue of it all. But basically, there's a group of people that when you are going to be indicted, the community has to assess the situation. He said there was a group of people that were very, you know, logical, open-minded. They were not hard-lined ideologues. And he said he was really lucky that when he got to presenting the case in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, he was not met with, you know, pitchfork-wielding right-wing Christian conservatives. He was met with more middle-of-the-road people who just looked at it and they thought, you know, why is our government spending our time like this? This is kind of dumb. And that was kind of like the first big break my dad got, was that it was just, you know, sort of a not hard line group of people, which again, John said to me, could have absolutely 100% not been the case. Had we been unlucky in that regard, if the community had come out in full force against, you know, God forbid, gay, Jewish, you know, Los Angeles, California, you know, West Hollywood, they could have had all of the things that they thought were just, you know, the devil about my parents. They would have, you know, been a harder sell. But he said it was just a group of people that were fair and open-minded and didn't look at them in that way.
That's kind of weird to think there was a time during a Republican's administration where people were fair and moderate.
Oh, my God.
You know, like, I wonder if today the smut rules, the smut laws that were around in the 80s with Edwin Meese and those fuckers, if they, like, what today would have happened. I think they might have been met with pitchforks and, like, you know, West Hollywood gay porn distribution, you know.
It's so interesting. Yeah, I wonder because, you know, on the one hand, I totally agree with you. There's just, like, hardcore, you know, right-wing Christian, you know, element. But on the other hand, there's this other thing where, like, porn is so out there now, whereas at the time it really wasn't quite as out there. You had to work a little harder to get it. And true. You know, now I just wonder if there's a softening of it, because come on, who doesn't look at porn? I mean, it's on everyone's phone. So there's just this thing where I think at that time, you know, of course everyone still found their way to find porn, but you know, now it's just, you know, I think people might have, you know, just, I don't know how we gauge this, but there's more easy access to it.
You know, I have a weird story related to this. Like about 15 years ago, I worked at a DVD company that was like a competitor with Netflix. So we were just like actually mailing. So our thing was that we did all the art house films and we did porn. But there was I worked in the warehouse where we actually did the shipping of DVDs across the country. And there was like sort of like this sort of in our system, there were like certain states that were like kind of flagged. It's like, hey, it's kind of not chill to send this gay porn to this state. It was still in 2005 or
was it just gay or any kind of
porn? We did all sorts of I did not do the buying, but
I mean, were those states flagged for gay? I'm just curious.
I mean, you know, this is also like talk within like the warehouse of the shipping department, so we probably did not have the full legal rationale behind this, but this company also was one of the early streaming companies, so they were doing stuff where I would walk by someone's desk, they'd be watching hardcore pornography and like metadata tagging it, like, well, this has anal, this is a black woman, you know, like that kind of thing.
Don't drop the soap. Let me see what he says about that one.
What are you looking for?
I'm just trying to find something that isn't quite as explicit.
What does he want?
He wants a white man and no penetration. Please.
These
guys look white to you, Jorge? Yeah, they're white. One of them, yep. All of them? Okay, good. Okay, so we'll take this one. Do these guys look white? See, all these boxes are full of DVDs. We made all the titles on this list here.
You guys made all of those?
Yeah, I sent you to college.
These are the videos that sent me to college?
They certainly helped.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
I think one of the first times I ever noticed the cognitive dissonance of seeing, you know, my elderly Jewish mom talk hardcore gay porn was I was sort of around it. You know, even I would have summer jobs my parents always made me work and my brothers and I all had to work at some point in some capacity, either in the warehouse or somewhere in proximity, but they would always sort of make sure we weren't like directly working with DVDs, but of course we were. And so, you know, a little hidden thing is that, you know, all of the files and the filing cabinets where I was writing the names of all the, my mom gave me a summer job where to write the names of all the production companies that they dealt with on the tabs for the files. But I didn't know, you know, I'm writing Vivid and Raging Stallion and all these like major production companies. And then So in the opening credits, that's where I put my directed by name as my own little funny joke. But I just thought, you know, it was this way in which it all became normalized and boring. You know, when I thought my friends in Hollywood had really cool parents. I had friends that, you know, I grew up in, you know, in this town, or friends of mine had stunt people for parents or makeup artists or, you know, actors. They were really cool and interesting. And then I would feel so sorry for myself. I'd be like, well, my parents have like stacks of invoices. And what do I come home to my mom complaining about payroll and taxes. And I mean, it was all just very mundane and boring. But then one time I remember I brought in a friend of mine to the back of the store, and he was just like walking in like, oh my God, your parents work here. This is so crazy. And we get to the back and my mom was on the phone and she sees me and she's just like holding up one finger, you know, as you do, like, oh, wait a minute, Rachel, I'll talk to you in a second, while she's talking to the person on the phone. And she's reading off this list of titles that, you know, goes on and on and on. And, you know, it's so raunchy. It's literally that list of, and my friend is sitting there looking at me like, and he's looking at me like, Rachel, what is, you know, and I had that, he's like that scene from Clerks, you know, where he's reading off the titles and, you know, it's just so hilarious. But there's my mom, you know, and then she hangs up the phone. She's like, oh, hi, John. What, you know, it's nice to see you here. How's school? And he's all scandalized, you know.
Hi, Mrs. Mason.
Right. No, he's like, hi, Mrs. Mason. How are you?
Speaking of anal blaster
right.
That's hilarious. Oh, my God. I grew up with really religious Christian parents, so I cannot imagine finding out that they ran a gay bookstore or video store or anything. That would be – so you found out through a friend, right?
How did I – well, yeah. No, I found out – I mean, I always knew they ran the store, and I always knew that we were not supposed to say what it was. And, in fact, another funny thing is that recently on Facebook, I was contacted by my old elementary school teacher who said, oh, my God, I watched the movie, and I had an actual memory of interviewing you for this social program where we had to find out – it was like social workers thing. They needed to find out information about parents, you know, a child welfare kind of thing. And so we had to ask kids what their parents did. And she said, I'll never forget, because you had a very like trained response when I said, well, what do your parents do? And she said, they own a bookstore. And she said, well, which one? And she said, I remember you repeating it like they owned a bookstore. It reminded me of that way in which, you know, the mafia kids are probably trained to say, you know, you say this. And I remember it was absolutely
garbage disposal. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well, what company exactly? And we were not allowed to ever say it. And I remember a few times teachers probing me like, come, oh, a bookstore. How amazing is that? And I'd have to be like, yeah, well, it's just a bookstore, you know.
We're at the forefront of literacy advocacy. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and they'd be like, which one? I know all the stores in town. Is it like Barnes & Noble? And I would really always be like, nope, nope, nope. It's just a bookstore. And it, remember, it was really funny because my mom had burned us in. So when I found out in high school, because I, of course, was all, you know, my friends were the total mavericks, you know, John Waters movies, finding all the weird shit that you could possibly find. And they would go
Blue Velvet.
Yeah, anything. Yeah, exactly. And it was VHS. So it was so cool. And, you know, and underground comics and all the stuff that you would find at the Circus of Books. And, of course, all my friends were queer. And I just, like, couldn't believe that my friends were making a special trip. I went to Cleveland High School in Reseda, and I had to make an hour-long bus ride because my school at the time would have been Hollywood High or Fairfax High, and both, for whatever reason, I think I remember they were like took a nosedive, and my mom didn't want to send me to these schools that were notoriously not good at that moment. So I was out in the valley with all these valley kids, and they were saying, you know, how cool it was that I lived in Hollywood and that they made these trips to come to Hollywood, and they would go to Circus of Books. And I would be like, I remember saying, well, my parents own that store. And they were like, what? No fucking way. That's the porn store, Rachel, you know. And it hit me like, okay, but my parents are so not cool. How does that work? You know, and I really remember that was sort of the beginning of that cognitive dissonance where I would probe them a little. And of course, my mom would be like, well, the store actually is a bookstore. You know, we do have a lot of other stuff in the store. And it's yes, it has an over 18 section. And in my head, I really thought that like every store had an over 18 section. I totally thought that. So, you know, the idea that it was a porn store just really took a while to sink in.
But they didn't have any other selections. They didn't have like a fiction section.
Well, they did actually for a while. Oh. You know, books were popular before, you know, the internet. Books were a thing. You know, people read. And, you know, it slowly got more and more diminished over time. But, you know, in the 80s, it really had a great literary side. It actually had a lot of stuff. And I've met people now, like Rose McGowan said to me that she went there for the Italian Vogue. And like other people have talked to me about, you know, there was a great magazine section and they really had, you know, interesting magazines. So not everybody went for the porn, but it was most known for the gay porn.
Right, right. Magazines do bring in people. There's something weird about magazines. I worked in a bookstore here on Haight Street. I live in San Francisco.
Okay.
And I worked at a bookstore on Haight Street, and I was in charge of the magazines. I was the periodicals manager, and that's the title I gave myself. But we had like 5,000 titles of magazines, and that definitely draws people in. There's some cool-ass magazines.
You were working the time. It was like the way you you did returns, you tore the cover off and mailed it back.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And that was how you did inventory.
Oh, yeah. No, I saw that happen thousands of, you know, that was what they did.
That's what you did. We used to stripe them because then you know which distributor it came from. So you would stripe different colors and tear the. And then I would bring home. We used to have in my apartment just stacks of magazines here.
Yeah, no, I remember my parents doing that too. All of us striping them and, you know, taking them back and all that. Yeah.
So did you ever work there? Did they ever employ their kids?
Well, yeah. I mean, I worked in the back doing clerical stuff, but I was terrible at it, so I got fired.
You got fired by her.
Yeah.
Let me guess. Karen fired you? It wasn't Barry.
No, I was not good at. I'm horrible at bookkeeping, and I had to do something, and I royally screwed it up. And it was, you know, one of their vendors like got an invoice that was all messed up, and of course, it was like Rachel. Okay. You cannot do that. You know, you have to get the numbers right. So, you know, they ran a really tight ship, actually. And my brothers, one of them, so they also had a newsstand for a while called Universal News. And my older brother worked there for a summer. And my younger brother, I believe, also worked in one of the warehouses. So we all basically had, you know, been employed doing something or other, you know, not necessarily in the store working the register, although actually my older brother did work the register one summer. So
it's what happens, I think, when parents, I mean, that's basically what you are. You're free employment. You know, your kids are free slave labor.
Exactly. Yeah. You can underpay them and overwork them.
So I had a question after watching this Doc, this morning. What gave you the idea to have a camera on you in the filmmaking process? Was that something that you were thought of beforehand, or you're like, oh, I'm going to have some visceral reactions to some of this stuff, so I should, like, what was the process through?
You know, initially, I wasn't going to direct this, actually. As weird as that sounds, I wasn't going to just do it all by myself. I had a producer who I met named Cynthia Childs, and I really felt the need to have like somebody that had already done a documentary helped me make this film. And immediately it became very clear, like right off the bat. And she's amazing. And her name's Cynthia Childs, and she's a producer on the project. And from day one, she just saw the dynamic with me and my mom and was like, wow, this is golden. It's hilarious the way you're just constantly, you know, bantering, and your mom does some amazing stuff. And I agreed. I watched it and I was like, yeah, you're right. You know, I don't mind. I'll just deal with it. And there was this sort of dynamic of what I could get out of my mom and what Cynthia could get out of my mom. And there'd be moments when basically it was like Karen Mason, the one that you see in the film, who's like, let me show you around the store. She would only do that if I wasn't there. And so there would be this thing where if I was there, my mom would be like, Rachel, this isn't interesting, you know, and then that would be this whole other thing. And it would be really funny. Like, oh my God, the amount of time my mom said, like, I don't understand why these people are still here filming. She would always say that when I was around, and it was really funny. And then you know, so the kind of comic value of the of my mom bantering with me was sort of baked in. And I think it took Cynthia seeing that. And then the other side of it was that I was originally just going to be kind of a talking head like my brothers. And I gave an interview, and it was a really cool interview, and it was great. But then as I started, you know, what happened was the project moved ahead, and it took a very long time. And eventually, a bunch of circumstances unfolded that led me to have to direct it. It really was like one of those things where my mom was not as happy about the whole movie as she initially was like, all right, just let's get it over with. I hate this project. But eventually, I know it's going to – I know everyone's going to lose interest. Like that was – she really assumed – everyone would lose interest. It would all go away. It didn't happen. And eventually, you know, my mom was like sort of a lesser willing participant. I had to really stake it out and say, okay, no, I'm going to just take it over and do the directing. And so I took the project over and, you know, also in post-production found an editor who, when I started really working with the footage, it was so clear that there was something completely missing from some of the dialogue that I'd had with my brothers, because it was very third person. It was framed in this way that, you know, it was very surface level. And in order to kind of get that feeling that, you know, no, the family is really like kind of wrestling with this, I had to redo those interviews and get a reverse angle shot in order for everything to make more sense. And it just started to make more sense because it really was the story of the film. I was discovering all this stuff that had never been told to me. And that's what I think gave the potency of the film, you know, it's, you know, it's sort of depth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the scene with you and Josh is very sweet and heartwarming. And was that the, like the first time you've ever heard him tell that, or was it kind of a vague notion? Or?
No, and that's also the other thing that came out in the interview. You know, I had interviewed him first just as a sort of like basic interview, and then when I realized I needed to go back in and just do it again, where you get my reverse angle shot, and I didn't know what was going to happen, what he was saying to me was so shocking because, you know, I was such a selfish teenager, like we all are, and I just cared about my little group of friends, and I was super gay, and all my friends were super gay, and I thought I was amazing, and I didn't have any space for my annoying little brother, who the hell cared who he was anyway, to, you know, have any kind of life. And so I'm like, wow. I mean, I'm best friends with my brother. I love him so dearly. And I'm like listening to him now tell me how closeted he was and how much he was struggling. And like, oh my God, he has this like total freak sister bringing home drag queens all the time. And then on the other hand, his parents running like the biggest gay porn enterprise in the world. And he's actually gay and cannot address it because he's trying to be the perfect Pete Buttigieg type kid, you know.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, I was so devastated to think your reference point for gay in culture was the kid that gets thrown out of the house by the dad. But I'm like, Josh, like, look at who our dad is. How could you even think that? And then I had that revelation of like, you know, also being a gay boy in the 90s when all you heard about was AIDS, and sick, gross, ew, disgusting. Like that, those were the words surrounding gay men. And, you know, I just was sort of blown away that I hadn't absorbed that. And I really hadn't until that scene. And so it's a true reaction. And I have to say, it's a collaboration with my editor. So I'm glad we're both nominated for an Emmy together because she, you know, really helped me recognize, no, when you start crying, Rachel, don't edit that out. Because I thought, oh God, I can't believe I started crying there. It's cut, you know, and she's like, no, yeah, that's very important. And so a lot of my self-consciousness was very tempered by my editor who kept saying like, wow, that's the great moment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's very powerful, and I think most people would have the effect of like, let's cut, let's stop rolling, like you know, like it takes. I mean, you really have to be in that moment to be like, listen, we have a moment here, and like we gotta just keep going forward, you know, because that is you're juggling so many plates at that point, you know, like you're interviewing, you're directing, you're on camera, you're hearing stories for the first time. You know.
Well, you know, I will say this might be where my background as an artist comes in handy because I am very comfortable performing. That was sort of my background. I'm performing in the indie avant-garde experimental music space that nobody cares about, but I was always on stage doing interesting things and performing, and you know, I worked my ass off, and I knew that, like, okay, this is what I have to do, and I have to perform. And I had that same feeling. I was like, all right, you cannot cut, this is the performance, and you have to just do it, but your job is to be authentic. So I in a way, I was able to very be strict with myself as a character. And also say, okay, your job is to have your editor sit here and tell you what to do. So I would, you know, I delegate. I say, Catherine, just tell me what's working, you know, and that's part of it, is that I think being, you know, it's so weird when people say, oh, you're a great director, because I think a really good director, at least in this job, is to actually say, well, I know what I'm not good at. I'm going to hand that over to someone else who's way better than me. My job is to kind of recognize what I am good at. And maintain my little silo in here so I don't start getting all over the place.
And you come from like an art school background, so it's like you're used to getting like very harsh criticism probably all the time.
Oh my God. Yeah, devastating. You know, art school is the most sadistic place on earth, because you just it's so weird when
next
you listen
film,
to
next film, next film. That's what you should make
it. Okay, that's actually it. You're right. No, it's well, reality TV show, I would say, because insane. I remember being in an art program where, like, literally the faculty will beat a student till they are on the floor crying in a puddle of, like, describing their, like, early sexual trauma. And I'm like, what is happening here? We're talking about a fucking painting. Are you actually, like, ripping this person into this devastating place where they might commit suicide? Because you are insane. Now, I remember having these moments where, like, you look at art faculty and you wonder, like, who the fuck are these people? It's the weirdest world. So, okay, there's your answer to that previous question of, like, a doc. But I don't think it could happen because it's such a protected, insular universe, the art world. And there's so much money and power right there. And I'm talking, like, money.
The real,
like,
money laundering. The real mafia. It's like, forget the porn industry. Look at the art, like, offshore value creation.
Yeah. No, it's so weird. I had a cousin in Switzerland, of all places, like a distant cousin who worked in Switzerland Swiss banks are a thing we all know about. So, you know, she worked in the money laundering department of the Swiss government oversight. And I remember I was there to be a performance artist. You know, you're like a trained monkey in a cage. Okay, do your thing for the art fair. The art fair is called Art Basel. Why is it held in Art Basel, Switzerland, of all places? Well, as I'm talking to my cousin, I just jokingly said, you know, I heard there was a lot of, like, international money laundering in the art fairs. Is that true? And I'm like laughing, and she gets this stone cold look on her face. She goes, I can't talk about that. And I'm like, wow, it's so true. Like, actual international drug smuggling, arms trading. And here you are, the weird artist who's, like, you know, just been beaten by your art teachers to, like, reveal your soul on canvas in some strange way. Now you're, like, dancing around for, you know, international drug smugglers. And then they're going to buy this thing and ship it over to the Bahamas. Yeah, it's definitely a doc.
Now, I was doing a little bit of research on this stuff you were doing, your performance art career. And I saw that you made a film before this film. And it's a scripted... is more of an experimental film.
Totally. In my naivety, I thought I could make a film made out of 20 songs that I sing all of them and weave together the story. It's my Hamilton, because it's called The Lives of Hamilton Fish, except the only thing is that I created this story based on a real, true, actual, fascinating discovery that I noticed. So as an artist, you're often exposed to this moment of weird, obscure history, and it's your job to kind of, like, figure something out of it. And a lot of art is really based on inspired, obscure subject matters. So I had discovered, I was a volunteer art teacher at Sing Sing Prison, the notorious prison in upstate New York where the Rosenbergs have been executed and a lot of mafia people. And I would go there every weekend to teach the men in this prison art, because I was working through this volunteer art program. And there was an art exhibition that I was invited to participate in near the town. And they said, could you do something that relates to the town of Peekskill? So I said, oh, okay, maybe I'll go to the public library. So I go to the public library, look up stuff about Sing Sing, which I thought was always an interesting, you know, starting place. And I see a book which listed all the people that have been executed at the Sing Sing electric chair. And the oldest person I've ever executed was a man named Albert Hamilton Fish. So I look up the date of his execution and I see on a front page newspaper, Hamilton Fish dies of a famous family in the South. Right there across the way on the same page, it says Hamilton Fish is executed at Sing Sing Prison. And I thought, okay, I went to the library and I said, this is actually really weird. Like, are there multiple Hamilton Fishes in this town? And she said, oh yeah, well, this is actually the Hamilton Fish Library. It's a very famous name. What? And I was like, wow, that's so weird. And I don't know how it just inspired me, as I'm a songwriter. And I had this sort of obsession with like old Americana murder ballad folk songs. And so I started writing piles of songs about the different characters interwoven in this story. And it was like 7 years of this thing being one of my backstory projects that I eventually did a little exhibition that someone wanted me to do, and I put together the story, and people were intrigued by it. So I wrote a feature film, and in the film, I play the role of the editor of the Evening Star News, which is the name of the newspaper, and all of the words and everything were very poetic in the language of those articles. So I wove together this whole sort of fantasy rock opera, and it was a hour-long project, and I toured with it as a musical, independent film. And actually, there's a film festival, I think it's called the We Make Movies Film Festival. Like, the world that I came out of is all these indie weirdos, and I toured all over the world. In fact, I toured it to Hong Kong as one of the first places I showed it, because I applied it to festivals, and it got in, and I performed with it.
Okay. Yeah, I saw that Shauna Moulton is in your film, too. And that's
You know Shauna?
Yeah, we went to college together, yeah.
At Carnegie Mellon.
Oh, no, Berkeley.
Okay, but you know what? She's that's the world I come out of. Weird video artists, yeah. You know. And Shauna played the role of Grace Budd, who's the mother of the little girl that got killed by Albert Hamilton Fish. So one Hamilton Fish was a serial killer, and his prime victims were children. And the other Hamilton Fish was a statesman, and he actually is a direct descendant of Alexander Hamilton, and that's where the name came from. So I remember when I found out, wow, there's a Hamilton musical happening when I'm making my Hamilton Fish musical. And, you know, anyways,
yeah,
it's a funny story.
Awesome.
Yeah, but I do come out of the world of, you know, people doing esoteric weird stuff. And so in a strange way, my sort of entree into having an Emmy, you know, people are like, what do you think of an Emmy? I'm like, wow, that's so weird. Like, my eye was always on like the Whitney Biennial and these other things. Like, the Emmys weren't something I even cared about. And I'm like, oh yeah, but actually it's a much bigger deal, Rachel. Ding, ding, ding. So I, you know, I've had this wake up call of a revelation too, where the worlds are not as separate as I always made them out to be. And, you know, I have to say, I got very bored with the art world. We're just really bored with it, because I thought it was the place where everybody could be like so free and experimental. And then I realized, oh wait, no, these are where the Russian oligarchs buy your stuff and said, right. You know, and then like these art collectors talk about you in these horrible ways. And you're standing there at an art fair and you're like, wow, everyone's on coke and they're really boring and tedious people. So I'd rather be with the regular people.
and right now it's like, even like all the museums, like there's all this stuff like SF MoMA, and I'm sure with the other museums where there's a real reckoning about racial stuff as well, and like,
well, yeah, and look at who, oh my god, and look at who are the donors to the museums. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, Mnuchin, and the, you're like, oh, oops, blood money.
Yeah, totally.
Well, when you're trying to raise billions to keep yourself floating, I mean, where's it going to come from?
No, yeah. So this film, what was the film festival that you first debuted at? Was it Tribeca?
Yeah. Okay. And we were not given a competition slot. I love to tell people that, because this film is an underdog. It's the ultimate underdog. And even I was like, okay, yeah, it's a gay porn movie. I'm an artist. I'm going to drop in, do this thing, and see everybody later. And, you know, I was really, at that point, by the time we premiered, I, of course, was like, God damn it, this thing better do well, because I put way too much time and effort into it. And, you know, and then we were given a non-competition slot. And I remember everybody on my phone was like, no, this is horrible, because this means we don't get a chance to actually fight for a best documentary. And we don't get a chance to be like considered with all those great documentaries. Like, to not get a competition slot at your world premiere was a huge blow. And I couldn't, you know, my team couldn't believe it. They were shocked and they were devastated. And it was also like we were in this little side section called Viewpoints, but I was in a sense of like, well, you know, I get it. I come out of the world of like gay porn. So I know that we're not the, you know, we're not going to be the Aretha doc, you know, we're going to be the gay porn doc. And so of course we're in the section called Viewpoints with student films and stuff, but everybody else was like, no, we do not deserve this. And then we were the only film out of Tribeca to make a sale instantly to Netflix. And then it was like, Ryan Murphy, The Pylon, and I had this moment where it was like Variety, Hollywood Reporter, all these things were just like blowing huge, you know, it was an instant. We were like super the hot shit. And I couldn't believe it either because I sort of expected to be the little runt who nobody cared about. And it was really profound because I do have to say, as like an LGBT story directed by a woman and it being a, you know, a small film that really, you know, by all accounts, even people in, you know, my little LGBT world were like, okay, good luck with that. You know, let's see how it does. It really was powerful and a powerful message, I think, to other queer filmmakers that, you know, you can go out on a limb and try something unexpected and it might do well. And I think it sent a bit of a shockwave. And I'm really proud to see that the film that won Tribeca this year was made by a friend of mine who made an autobiographical, super gay film about his family in the South, the Deep South. And I met this guy, Bo, and he basically, you know, came up to me and he told me that my film was a major inspiration for him being able to tell a super authentic personal story. And it won Tribeca.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow. Yeah.
So they gave a gay film a competition slot this year.
Yeah. The version that was at Tribeca, was there any subsequent cuts to the version that is now on Netflix, or is it pretty much the same?
Nope, that is the version. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. You really tie everything into, there's a bunch of stuff I learned from this. Like I didn't know about the Black Cat arrests or those protests. And I live right by there. I live kind of close to the store. Wow. On Sunset and all that stuff. So, and then Alexei Romanov's a really compelling figure to bring in there. So tying that sort of history of the civil rights aspect of it together with a very personal family story. And then obviously then just at the end, your mom sort of having this conversion moment of being the best advocate for her son and for the PFLAG movement and stuff. So I really, you know, it's really a pretty, it went a lot of different directions and I was kind of in it more for what I thought was going to be the funny, like Larry David-y kind of moments of it. And then really at the end, I was just like, that's such a good mom. You know,
I know.
That's how I felt.
You know, I have to say what was the most poignant thing for me being on the festival circuit and, you know, it's such a devastating loss to look at it now in this COVID moment. When I think about all the other films that aren't getting what I had on the festival circuit, which was I showed the film in front of an audience and I felt like I was seeing it for the first time play out in ways that just blew my mind. When I showed it at Outfest here in LA, oh my God, I felt like I was literally in church or something. Like everybody was clapping and when they saw Jeff Stryker, they were, you know, crying. I mean, it was just, you felt that euphoric sense of like the community that gets it, that knows all the players. And then, you know, I showed it in a country, I showed it in Ecuador, and it was shocking because to go in South America at this moment and just be, you know, here we are in Donald Trump's America presenting this super gay film, and it was at a gay film festival in Ecuador. And afterwards, these amazing young people were telling me things like that they just felt their mother in my mom. And it was a total like Catholic, Jewish, like doesn't matter. It's just like, that is my mom. And it gives me hope that she could come around and find a way through her religion. And that was one of those things where I recognized, wow, that message of my mom's religious reckoning is weirdly the big story of the film. It's not just the gay porn story. It's actually, you know, it's a gay porn story that's like the surface layer couched around the really important heart of it, which is, you know, a mother really kind of grappling with her religious values, which I still think is fundamental to the gay rights and LGBT rights situation of today.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that is, I mean, there's so many universal truths in what you just said. Like, you can't, once you can, like, envelope in those universal truths, it can be a kind of a story about anything. Mm. But when it comes down to, like, mothers loving their sons, fathers loving their daughters, loving their children, and having to grapple with this religion that tells them they shouldn't and can't and better not. And so this, your story would have been fundamentally different if your mom had just been like, you know what? I can't deal with this stuff. I got my God. I got my church, you know, Josh, whatever. Like, I hope you figure it out. It would have been
if my mom had been more of like a weirdo hippie radical, like my friend's parents, who I was super jealous of. I'm like, damn it. You don't have to go to synagogue. That's so not fair. You know, I think, you know, it would have made it less interesting if my mom had actually been part of the culture. And so in a way, I think, but I think my mom is like a lot of other parents out there. And I think that's what I was so struck by. We are all, I mean, so few people that I know have no religiousness in their life. Most people have some kind of religion that they have to grapple with in their family. And it's, it's usually really a fucked up layer of like, well, okay, how are we going to deal with this, like, oppressive? It doesn't even have to be gay. You know, I was always taught, like, okay, well, the worst thing you could ever do is marry somebody that's not Jewish. Like, that is the biggest sin.
And well, I'm a Scientologist, so, you know. Okay. Like, yeah, that's, we have our own PR issues.
Wow. Okay.
No, he's not. He's joking.
You know, when people tell me that, I always just say, okay.
Yeah. Cool.
They start backing away.
All right. Gotta go. Bye.
Like, I live in LA, so
it's true. I live in Los Feliz, so yeah, it's all around.
Speaking of LA for just a second, like when I saw this doc this morning too, I was like, this is almost like a fundamentally LA story as well to me. To me, as not an LA person, I lived there for a little bit, but like it's so, there's so many contradictions involved.
I see that
story.
Yeah.
It seems so push and pull, which is the feeling I get about LA, is that there's so many pushes and pulls, and I just found like a LA story involved in this.
Well, thanks for telling me that because, you know, that really actually does mean a lot. And I will say, you know, we're in a moment where everybody wants to see everybody represented on screen in every possible way. And, you know, I should not laugh, but it was one of those things where it was on Twitter one day and somebody was like, why are there no handicapped people disabled people? Why are there so few black people in this movie? And why are there so few Asians? And it was like one of those things where I was like, well, actually, because it's a Jewish family and these happen to be the employees that my parents had, I couldn't just pack it with people that didn't exist. Yeah. And I'm not going to, you know, you can't, but there's a sense with every movie right now that you have to get everything right. And, you know, And I think it's so insane, actually, because I really care about, like, I just, you know, was on a jury and my favorite, you know, I was so excited about this film. It was entirely about young black trans kids. And I mean, the worst thing I could say is like, well, let's try to make sure that it gets this person and that person and vice versa. You know, there's, you know, a sense that you have to try to pack your film in with everything. But when you look at the actual story of Circus of Books, my parents hired trans people back before it was even a thing. I remember I was a kid meeting Dolly, a Korean War vet who literally was more manly than most any man I've ever met. And she had the most giant boobs of any woman I've ever met to this day. And my parents never said, well, this is Dolly. She's a transsexual woman.
Right.
It was just like, this is Dolly. You better like be nice to her and sit down when she tells you to do this or that. And, you know, they went and were at the bedsides of so many different employees who were black, Hispanic, Asian. It didn't matter. They were dying of AIDS and they were going to show up for these kids. And where were their families? Christian families. So, you know, sort of an interesting thing where I saw the melting pot of LA in that store. And my parents were deeply in that store. But also, you know, we are Jewish and Jewish was never really, accepted into our society in the ways that people often think. I mean, I do have to say there's a lot of Jews in Hollywood. That is true. So, okay. But why did Jews go to Hollywood? Because they were kicked out of every other place. I remember I had a friend whose dad worked in the railroad company, and he had a really shitty job. And my mom was like, "Oh, he's so lucky he got that job." And I was like, "Really? He's like a switcher at the railroad engineer." And my mom was like, "That's the job my dad always wanted, but you know they didn't hire Jews."
Oh,
so
wow!
You think of the background of Jews getting kicked out of other industries, so they landed in Hollywood. They porn. A lot of Jews are in these industries that are sort of like the side angle. So I actually do think of this as a kind of a Jewish story too.
Oh yeah, we think we both, Paco and I, sort of picked up on that as well. Where I was thinking the way like Transparent is sort of has this layer of Judaism is like about yeah. that as well. This sort of yeah,
totally
culturally. So mm-hmm. yeah,
yeah. Before we start recording, I was like, I wish we had like a. Neither of us are Jewish, George and I. So I'm like, you know, like we can't really.
Oh
talk.
Well, I gotta go then. I'm kidding.
Well, like I have a Chinese mom that feels a little bit like your mom, so it's a very similar kind of.
Oh my god, that's so similar. Yeah. Oh my god, yeah, my parents really connect to the Chinese work ethic vibe of like small business owners.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, the small, and that's all I've ever worked for until about 2 weeks ago, were small mom and pop shops. That's all I've ever worked at.
I think that's its own ethnicity, the race of small mom and pop business owners.
Yeah, absolutely. They're all the same.
They're all the same.
you can go anywhere in this country and they're all be the same. They're all like kind of like that hyperkinetic energy your mom had when
anxiety.
She was, that's the word I was looking for. It's called anxiety. Like when your mom goes to that expo and she's just like, send me like a box of the cock rings and then you know, like I'm like, oh my god, that's just so awesome. You know, because it's the retail shop owners all have that kind of kinetic that anxiety.
Well, they're always on the edge that it could all fall apart and fail at any moment, and when it fails it's going to take everything down with it. So that's sort of the feeling. It's like, you know, if you quit a regular job, you're working at IBM or somewhere, it's like, all right, well, I'll guess I'm out of here. But you know, when your business fails, I mean, I think that's sort of the constant paranoia of like it could all fail. It's just sort of always there.
Did you see your parents? That just occurred to me too. Like most like small business owners work like 18-hour days. Like they work Saturdays and Sundays.
Yeah, they never took a day off ever.
Yeah,
I mean, my mom even said we took our first family vacation when we were like 10 years old as kids. Like we were, you know. And I was like, wow. So that was like a decade of work all weekend, every day, you know.
Right.
I mean, on the other hand, I'll say this. I think my parents enjoy work. I think they actually love it. And I think there's a side of, you know, things where, you know, you work really, really, really hard because you're actually enjoying it. So I think there's some part, I mean, I do think there's a difference between that, you know, yes, it's panic inducing and scary, but there's maybe enjoying isn't the wrong word, but maybe it's like they're addicted to it. And there's that adrenaline rush, you know, of just like, okay, let's like keep it going. It's getting crazier.
There's so many more questions to go down just in terms of like, you know, were you based on the East Coast and then you moved back to California to do this?
Yeah, I was, you know, trying to be an artist in New York, as one is, you know, when they're trying to be an artist. And and then when I realized the store was closing, it was like, oh, okay, L.A. will be without Circus of Books and you won't get a chance to do this again. So that really drove me here.
And so what's next for you? What's coming up?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a whole bunch of projects and they're all in these different states of development. And one that basically, again, an art/music project that I've been working on for the whole duration of Circus of Books. I wrote a musical feature film and it's all about black holes. And it's a very sci-fi script and it's so crazy. But it sounds so insane, and I'm developing it potentially as a podcast to start the ball rolling on that. And I have a few other doc projects that, you know, I guess I can't say too much because they're sort of being shopped around. But, you know, it's weird for me, but I have an amazing agent right now. It's UTA, and they are just so killer. So I'm having meetings with people where I'm like, wow.
Yeah, that's pretty major.
Yeah, no, they're so cool. And I mean, it's like, you know, I was always that person that no one cared about. So I guess now some people care a little bit about me and I'm meeting people that can actually like, you know, green light big projects. Yeah.
That's awesome.
There's going to be some docs coming from me soon. Awesome. So.
And maybe framed the art school musical at some point. I just titled it for you.
You know, it's so weird because I do think if it was going to be something about art school, it would be so dark.
It would have to be.
Insane. So it's actually a great idea. Yeah. I'll have to talk to Ryan Murphy about that.
There you go. A lot of corduroy. Yeah. You'd have to spend a lot of money on corduroy.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Congratulations on your Emmy nomination on your debut film.
Thanks. Yeah. All right. Well, this was really fun. And thanks for being enthusiastic about docs because docs are still the underdogs. So keep fighting for us.
Will do. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com.
Recapping reality since 2015.
Our theme song was written by the very talented David Siegel, and our show is engineered by the immensely talented Will Scovel. And if you want to help us out, just share the show. Let your friends know about it and let your enemies know about it.
Join the Doc Talk and check out our hot takes, pictures, and videos on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. We're SupDoc Podcast on all of those mediums.
And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It really does help.
Find Paco and George's comedy gigs on the About Us page on the SupDoc Podcast website.
If you want to advertise with SupDoc, you got a film, you got opinions, you got corrections, hit us up. We'd love to hear from you and what you're docking out on these days.
We'd love to hear from you. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.